So today I'll present some research from my recently completed PhD at the University of Victoria, looking at patterns of diversity in arboreal and terrestrial orbatted mite communities. Orbatted mites mostly inhabit soil and litter habitats, particularly ones that are marked by high abundance of organic matter. As such, they tend to be the dominant microarthropods that we find in forest floor soils, but they can also be rather dominant in treetops and arboreal habitats associated with trees and forests as well. Given that orbatted mites are pretty small, they're wingless, they're mostly non-phoretic, and they're cursorially slow-moving, it sort of begs the question, how did they get into the canopy and what exactly are they doing up there? So in terms of habitats that are available within treetops, it ranges from very simple habitats like exposed leaves and needles to rather complex habitats such as moss and lichen accumulations and soils that are associated with epiphytes as well. Today I'll be talking about the forest system that I'm most familiar with, which is the temperate rainforest on the west coast of North America. And these forests are conifer forests. And the primary canopy habitats that are up there are associated with moss and lichen and the epiphytes that are associated with soil or the soils that are associated with epiphytes as well. So my study site is on the west coast of Vancouver Island in a valley called the Walbrand Valley, which is located on the southwest coast of Canada. And it's a great post-glaciation U-shaped valley. It's dominated by western hemlock, but there's significant amounts of western red cedar and Sitka spruce in this forest. And the trees and the stands and these forests are what we term as ancient forests. And what we mean by this is that since glaciation, they've never been harvested. In this particular study site, there's some historical and current logging activity. You can see in the foreground of this picture, there's a clear cut that's approximately 20 years old. But the majority of the valley and my particular study site has never been harvested and is relatively untouched. And I'll focus on one tree in particular, and these are the western red cedar trees. They're a pretty neat tree. They're not the tallest in the valley. The Sitka spruce can grow to be 80 or even 90 meters in height. The western red cedars, they're about 50 meters in height. But what they make up for their height in terms of their biomass. They typically have a big barrel trunk. This trunk can be quite large in girth. It can actually get upwards of or even exceed 5 meters in diameter. And they tend to lack any significant branching structure until the actual upper canopy. And so this figure here is actually showing just the top third of a tree. This is tree number 4 in my study site. The rest of this picture is simply a big barrel trunk that's devoid of limbs. And it's got a very unique morphology where the limbs, they grow out and then they grow up. And they essentially form secondary trunks. So there's a series of sort of trunk reiterations that occur. It gives this overall morphology, which we refer to as a candelabra type structure. And the structure combined with the fact that there's very little epiphytic growth on the bark means that we get very discrete patches of habitat up in the canopy. And these patches really only occur where litter is able to accumulate. So they occur in the crotches, they occur in these trunk bifurcations. And because these trees are also rather old, they're 800 to 1200 years old, these accumulations have been accumulating over decades or even close to a century. And they can be small sort of accumulations, 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters, or they can actually get to be 1 by 2 meters in surface area, and they can be over half a meter deep as well. And these habitats I'll refer to as suspended soils. And so suspended soils form by the accumulation of organic matter over long periods of time. They're very much like a forest floor in that they have distinct soil layers, or at least organic soil layers. So they have an L layer and an FH layer underneath, which is actually decomposing matter. And they tend to be topped off by moss and other types of epiphytes. Typically you'll find ferns up at the canopy. You'll also find herbaceous plants, huckleberry and blueberry. And in this particular suspended soil, there's actually a conifer tree growing up. This is 35 meters in the canopy. So it's like there's a second forest happening up in the canopy of these trees. And so you can see it's a very complex habitat, very rich in organic matter, and ultimately it's the perfect habitat to find orobatted mites in. So a little bit more about these suspended soils based on the sampling that we've done. The nutrient content is actually very high up in the canopy. Nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, all significantly greater in the canopy compared to the forest floor. Likely due to differences in the quality of the litter that's being inputted in the canopy, as well as differences in rates of uptake of nutrients. Soil pH, though, not significantly different from the forest floor, and surprisingly, decomposition rates were not significantly different from the forest floor. A little bit reduced in the canopy, but not statistically. The big difference, though, is soil moisture. The canopy is a very dry habitat. And you can see by this graph, this is sampling over 2.5 years, moisture content in the canopy tends to be about half of what we find on the forest floor. So it's a very dry habitat. And throughout my sampling, I've found that orobatted mite richness and abundance tends to always be positively and significantly correlated with moisture content, both in the canopy and in the forest floor. So looking at some of these orobatted mite communities, the abundances, this is a standardized abundance, so number of individuals per gram dry weight of substrate, canopy versus the forest floor. A little bit variable, but the actual density, the number of individuals we're finding, doesn't seem to be that different from the forest floor. But richness tends to be significantly less in the canopy. And so again, this is standardized, so it's the number of individuals per gram dry weight that we're finding in the canopy. But what is interesting is that there's an interesting habitat by time interaction in this, in both the abundance and the richness data. It's very weak. It's not significantly statistically significant. But if you look just within the blue bars, so within the canopy, abundance and richness tends to be greater in June versus September, and we sort of see the opposite trend on the forest floor, where abundance and richness tends to be higher in September versus in June. And I think this is something that is rather interesting. It requires maybe a little bit more investigation. It wasn't something I was originally looking for, and I personally think it might have something to do with moisture limitation up in the canopy, given that it's such a dry habitat. Perhaps canopy orobatted mite communities are active earlier in the season to take advantage of moisture conditions before the dry summer goes on. Just within the canopy system, the richness as well as the abundance tends to be related to how big the habitat patch size is. So the figure on the left there is a series of rare fraction or species accumulation curves for suspended soil patches of three different sizes. I'll just tell you that the sampling effort was equal for the small, medium, and large patches, and you can see that there's definitely more individuals that I found in the large patches, as well as more species found in the large patches. And the second graph on that slide is actually from the same set of data. So this is absolute number of species found in each of these 72 suspended soil patches that I looked at, plotted against how big these suspended soil patches are. And so again, we can see that species richness tends to increase with increasing size of the habitat patch. In this case, it follows very nicely a power law equation, which is similar to a species area type relationship that you might see. In this case, I'm using volume instead of area. One last piece of sort of general information I'll tell you about these canopy orobatted mites, and that is that they're not the same species that we're finding on the forest floor. There's definitely a distinct canopy community that occurs up there. So in the 118 species that I collected over 2.5 years, only about 35% community similarity between the canopy community and the forest floor community. Overall, we had high species richness in the canopy as well as on the forest floor. Total of 83 species I collected from canopy habitats, 94 species that were collected from the forest floor. And I'll just let you know that many of these species were or are potentially undescribed species, estimated at least one quarter, but perhaps even two thirds of these species are currently undescribed. This is canopy and forest floor. And we've had actually a couple of new records in terms of genera and even at the family level for Canada and North America. And so given this, this sort of led to a series of investigations on the differences between the canopy and the forest floor or abatted mite communities, and why might these species differ between the canopy and the forest floor. And there's sort of two broad thoughts on this. The first one is that, well, one reason why these communities might be different is because these habitats are actually different, and in particular, I've already sort of mentioned the role of moisture. The second is perhaps just limited dispersal. So perhaps these communities are distinct because individuals are not able to move among these two habitats. And so I'll present just a subset of the data that I collected on this, and I'll start with the last one there, the limited dispersal. So when I first learned that orabatted mites were living in the canopy, my first thought was this forest floor, which is such a rich source of orabatted mites, it must be the colonizing source pool. Orabatted mites must be coming from the forest floor into the canopy habitats. And this was also sort of the thought in the early 70s. Aoki put forward the idea that the species that were found in the canopy as well as on the forest floor, he termed them wandering forms in a paper that he actually titled Orabatted Mites Climbing Trees. Even though there's no evidence for the actual mechanism of orabatted mites climbing the trees. And it wasn't until relatively recently, in a study by Heather Proctor, where they suggested, well, tree trunks likely aren't highways of dispersal for orabatted mites to colonize the canopy. And this was done based on sampling of the bark habitat, just at one sample height. And so what I really wanted to do is I wanted to document the vertical distribution of orabatted mites that were living on the bark in this corticolous habitat. So I did this by sampling 5 western red cedar trees. I collected individuals every 2 meters from the base of these trees up to 36 meters in the canopy, and just identified all the individuals. And I tested for evidence of tree trunks as dispersal corridors by looking for a pattern of spatial autocorrelation. And what this is simply a measure of community similarity as a function of how far apart two communities are. And so there were 3 potential patterns that I was looking for. The first pattern there up at the top would be indicative of species with very high dispersal. So species would be able to move around, they would be able to reach all sample locations, and so you would expect to find high similarity among any sort of sample communities, and the similarity wouldn't be related to how far apart the communities were from each other. The second pattern I was looking for is our classic spatial autocorrelation pattern, whereby community similarity decreases with the distance between two communities. And this is often indicative of natural corridors that we see in nature. And then the third pattern that I thought was potentially going to turn up was or would be indicative of species that are highly dispersal limited. So in this case, individuals with limited dispersal aren't able to move around very much. Species would be found in only 1 or 2 sample locations. And so generally, any two communities would have low similarity to each other, and this similarity would be independent of how far apart these two communities were. So this is the data that we found. And so 62 species of orabatted mites were collected from tree trunks, and most of the species we had seen before, but there were a few corticola specialists that were specific to the bark that didn't turn up in our canopy or our forest floor sampling. And generally we have this decreasing trend of similarity between with increasing distance between our sample points. And so these plots are often called distance decay plots. And how they're read is, so each of these data points is a pairwise community similarity value, so how similar two communities are, and along the x-axis is how far apart those communities are. And so that first column of data points is community similarity between sample locations that are separated by a distance of 2 meters. So this is how similar 0 and 2 meters are, 2 and 4 meters are, 4 and 6 meters are. And as we move sort of up the axes there, we end up with that one data point, which is the average community similarity between the communities that are located at the base of the tree, 0 meters, and 36 meters up in the canopy. And so we have this sort of general decreasing community similarity with increasing distance between two data points, or two sample locations. But this wasn't the whole story, because based on our previous sampling and our knowledge of the distribution and the species that we were finding, we were able actually to identify two distinct communities. And we found that ground-specific species were climbing up onto trees, they were colonizing the trunks, but they were only found below 4 meters. So they were available at the base of the tree, they were there at 2 meters, they were there at 4 meters, but ground-dwelling species were never found above 6 meters. The canopy dwellers were found throughout the bark profile, but didn't ever sort of come below 6 meters. So we had these very distinct two communities, ground dwellers up to 4 meters, canopy species 6 meters and above. And then when we readdress our distance decay plot here and we look at just the canopy community, we see that pattern of distance decay actually disappears. Community similarity does not decrease with distance, and we have generally low similarity among these sample locations. And so taken together, these sort of suggest two things. The first thing is that tree trunks are, as Heather Proctor suggested, not highways of dispersal for orobated mites to colonize the canopy. And second, that the canopy community might be dispersal limited as well within a tree. And some of this data is actually corroborated in the next experiment that I'm going to talk about. This was an experiment of artificial canopy habitats, and the main indication from this is that the potential colonizing source pool of orobated mites in the canopy is other canopy sources. And so in this case, I looked at the similarity of the orobated mites that were colonizing artificial canopy habitats with the potential source pools, and the forest floor was always the lowest. It had the lowest similarity with the species that were found in there. Highest similarity was with other suspended soil habitats. And so a few slides ago, I asked why might canopy and forest floor communities be different, and our first indication is that, well, they're simply not mixing. Ground-dwelling species are actually climbing up onto the trunks of trees, but not getting very far, and they're definitely not climbing all the way up into the canopy. And likewise, the canopy community isn't climbing all the way down the bark into the soil. But another suggestion was that the difference in environmental conditions between these two habitats is going to keep these communities separate. And in line with that, in 2007, Chase proposed that communities such as drought and harsh communities like the canopy are going to have species that are very deterministic in nature, and it's going to be dependent on the environmental tolerances of these species. And so I examined how patch size, height in the canopy, and moisture availability affected the abundance, species richness, and community composition of orobated mites. And to do this, I used an experimental system of artificial canopy habitats. These habitats I created myself using raw cedar planks, and they were created to be three different sizes, each size doubling in surface area. They were placed at three different heights in the canopy, at 5 meters, 15 meters, and 30 meters. And originally defaunate, they were left in the canopy for 1 year and allowed just to be colonized by natural sources. And so these were the results. So abundance and richness decreased with height in the canopy. Richness increased with the moisture content in these artificial canopy habitats. And I'll tell you that moisture content and height were strongly and negatively correlated. So the artificial canopy habitats that were high in the canopy were had extremely low moisture content compared to the canopy habitats that were lower in the canopy. And then richness also increased with patch size. And so this is again sort of another species area type relationship with the power law equation, this time using substrate dry weight as a proxy for size. And we can see increasing species richness with increasing size of the habitat patch. So these trends, we've seen them before. They weren't really surprising, but what was really great about using an experimental system is that we could test for patterns of non-randomness in the trends that we were seeing. And so richness and community composition, I looked at whether the patterns that we were finding were non-random, and indeed they were. So the figure on the left there, this is the observed species richness in each of the artificial canopy habitats minus the expected species richness based on random placement hypothesis, which is a null hypothesis for the species area relationship. And you can see that most of these data points fall below that zero, which is our 1-to-1 line. So they had significantly less species richness than expected. And this trend became increasingly apparent with increasing height in the canopy. And so those red diamonds are 5 meters, the blue triangles are 15 meters, and those yellow circles are all our really dry canopy habitats up there at 30 meters. And all those data points have less than expected species richness associated with them. So non-random patterns in species richness, also non-random patterns in community composition, whereby we found a significant pattern of nestedness. And what that means is that the species that we found in high, dry, small artificial canopy habitats were nested subsets of the species that we were finding in large, low, moist artificial canopy habitats. Going in line with the predictions that Chase put forward, that communities in very harsh habitats are going to be more deterministic, we found evidence of that as well. So this figure on the right here, it's an NMDS ordination plot. Each of the data points, again, is an artificial canopy habitat, and the community similarity is dictated by how far apart these data points are. So any two data points that are close together are quite similar. Data points that are further apart are less similar. And you can see all those 30-meter artificial canopy habitats clustering really tightly together. The communities were very similar to each other, high in the canopy, and less so as we go down. This is the last slide. And so, just a few things to conclude. The arboreal or abetted mite communities, they're distinct from the forest floor communities, both having high species richness associated with them. Factors that are affecting the arboreal or abetted mite diversity and community structure are related to the size of the habitat patch, which is related to the complexity of the habitat patch and the age of the habitat patch. Moisture content of the substrate is also very important, which again is also related to the size. And also, I didn't talk too much about it, but I do believe that stochastic or random dispersal events are important in maintaining and generating diversity in the canopy. And lastly, I just want to say that the prevalence of many of the undescribed species and simply the high diversity both in the canopy and on the forest floor really supports the conservation initiatives for these ancient temperate forests. Thanks. Did I go over?
You made it just in.
Just in.
Okay. One or two questions, quick questions.
Fred.
Zoe, you think that the dwellers all not very good dispersers, correct?
I flip-flop on that. I think it changes with the spatial scale and the temporal scale that you're talking about. I think on a day-to-day basis, orobatted mites living in a suspended soil habitat patch don't escape that habitat patch. I think they're dispersal limited within a tree. I don't think they move around much there.
So if it falls on the ground,
that
they climb back up, at least generalis or something.
That would infer that they would know how to get back up. What's interesting is, yeah, I've found huge big soil mats on the forest floor. You know they're from the canopy because they're upside down, the moss side is down, and I've sampled from them. I keep expecting, you know, this has got to be a great source of you know, mass influx of species to the forest floor, and I have no idea how long they've been there, but usually when I sample them, I don't find canopy mites. So they're not found on the forest floor. Occasionally you might find one or two individuals, but they don't seem to survive. I don't know. Yes.
Have you thought about using some molecular tools to see if those communities within the same tree are even seeing gene flow between the same species?
No, I haven't. That's a great idea. I did have a similar idea, which is I wanted to look at the species that were shared in common between the canopy and the forest floor and do molecular work on that. But I started it, and then I never actually was able to get any good resolution on that data.